first 3 weeks. It performs basic functions only now. It knows perfectly well it's never going to be called on for reproductive purposes. I'm a wireless set. Pen shrugged, nodding, with her mouth twisting skeptically and her eyebrows raised. Her mannerisms are what you'd imagine in a pioneering farmer's wife.
Well, you don't look so healthy, she said to me.
I look like I've just emerged from a sanatorium and I'm about to lose a long battle with consumption. Starvation and sleep deprivation do leave visible marks, you idiots. I haven't seen the sun for 6 weeks, I said. But sometimes the weather's like that back home, too.
Well, it's sure nice, she drawled. It's nice to see they're treating prisoners so well here.
Suddenly, in one great dollop, she sloshed all her cognac, untouched, the entire glass, into my glass. I slugged the whole lot back in one like a sailor before anyone could take it away from me, and spent the rest of the afternoon being sick. Do you know what he did last night? Von Linden, I mean. Came and stood in the doorway of my cell after he'd finished work, and asked me if I'd read Goethe. He has been chewing over this idea that I can buy time in exchange for bits of my soul, and he wondered if I likened myself to Faust. Nothing like an arcane literary debate with your tyrannical master while you pass the time leading to your execution. When he left, I said to him, Je vous souhaite une bonne nuit. I wish you a good night. Not because I wished him a good night, but because that is what the German officer says to his unyielding, passive-resistant French hosts every night in Le Silence de la Mer, that tract of Gallic defiance, and the literary spirit of the French resistance. A copy was given to me by a French woman I trained with, just after she was brought back from the field late last year. I thought that von Linden might have read it too, as he is such a know-your-enemy type. Also, he is very well read. But he didn't seem to recognize the quotation. Engel has told me what he did before the war. He was rector of a rather posh boys' school in Berlin. A headmaster. Also, he has a daughter. She is safe at school in Switzerland, neutral Switzerland, where no Allied bombers raid the skies at night. I can safely assert she doesn't go to my school. My school shut down just before the war began, when most of the English and French pupils were pulled out, which is why I went off to university a bit early. Von Linden has a daughter, only a little younger than me. I see now why he takes such a clinically distant approach to his work. Still not sure whether he has a soul, though. Any Jerry bastard with his wedding tackle intact can beget a daughter. And there are a lot of sadistic head teachers about. Oh my God, why do I do it again and again? I have the brain of a ptarmigan hen. He will see anything I write. Or May. 21-11-43. JBS. Engel, bless her, skipped over the last few paragraphs I wrote yesterday when she was translating for von Linden last night. I think it was self-preservation on her part rather than any good nature towards me. Someone will eventually discover what a chatterbox she is, but she's growing wise to my efforts to get her in trouble. She pointed out to von Linden some time ago that I know perfectly well how to do metric conversions, and only pretend ignorance to torment her, but it is true that she is better at them than I am. In addition to my extra week, I've now been given a fresh supply of paper. Sheet music. Surely also the ill-gotten spoils of the Château des Borreaux. A lot of popular songs from the last decade and some pieces by French composers scored for flute and piano. The verso of the flute parts are all blank, so I have paper in abundance again. I was getting a bit weary of those flipping recipe cards. We're still using them for the other work. Wartime administrative formalities. I'm condensing now. I can't write fast enough. Maddie was being groomed by the SOE long before she became aware of it. About the same time Jamie started flying again somewhere in the south of England. Back in Manchester, Maddie was put on a course to do night flying. She leapt at the chance.
She was so used to being the only girl around, there being no more than two other women in the Manchester ATA ferry pool, that it did not occur to her that there was anything unusual going on. Everyone else on the course was a bomber pilot or navigator. The ferry pilots don't fly at night in general. In fact, Maddie didn't fly at night for a while after she'd clocked the hours and had her logbook stamped, and she had a difficult time keeping in practice because she used it so little. Since 1940, we have not come off daylight saving at all, and in summer it is double, which means for a whole month it doesn't get dark till nearly midnight. Maddie couldn't have used her night flying anyway in the summer of 1942 unless she'd gone up in the middle of the night, so she didn't wonder about it. She was busy, 13 days on ferrying and 2 off, in all kinds of weather, and there were so many ongoing senseless administrative formalities or blunders that a bit of pointless night training was unremarkable. They gave her parachute training too, an equally random and apparently useless skill. Maddie was trained not as an actual paratrooper, but she learned to fly the plane while people were jumping. They use Whitley bombers for the parachute training, a type Maddie hadn't flown before, and they flew from her home airfield. Nothing about it seemed strange until she was asked to come along as pilot too, when I was making my first jump from a plane over the low hills of Cheshire. At this point I had no choice but to cross heights off my list of fears. Maddie certainly hadn't expected me, and was too sharp to take it as a coincidence. She recognized me instantly as we climbed on board, despite my hair being uncharacteristically tied back with a ribbon like a pony club competitor. Otherwise it wouldn't have fitted inside those ducky wee helmets that make you look as though you've stuck your head in a Christmas cake. Maddie knew better than to register surprise or recognition. She'd been told who this group was, or who they weren't, anyway. 6 of them, 2 of them women, jumping from a plane for the first time. We weren't allowed to talk to the pilots either. I made 3 jumps that week. The women do 1 less training jump than the men, and they make us jump first. I don't know if that's because we're considered cannier than men, or braver, or bouncier, or just less likely to survive and therefore aren't worth the extra petrol and parachute packing. At any rate, Maddie saw me twice in the air and never got to say hello. I got to watch her fly, though. You know, I envied her. I envied her the simplicity of her work, its straightforward nature, the spiritual cleanness of it. Fly the plane, Maddie. That was all she had to do. There was no guilt, no moral dilemma, no argument or anguish. Danger, yes, but she always knew what she was facing. And I envied that she had chosen her work herself and was doing what she wanted to do. I don't suppose I had any idea what I wanted. And so I was chosen, not choosing. There's glory and honor in being chosen, but not much room for free will. 13 days flying and 2 days off. Never knowing where she'd get her next meal or spend the night. No social life to speak of. But moments, now and then, unexpected and unlooked for, of solitary joy. Alone in the sky in the cruise, straight and level at 4,000 feet over the Cheviots or the Fens or the Marches, or dipping her wings in salute to a passing Vic of Spitfires. With Thomas her co-pilot, she was his senior by 100 hours flight time, she delivered a Hudson to RAF special duties. You have to take a pilot assistant with you when you ferry a Hudson. The Moon Squadron used them for nighttime parachute drops, the Hudsons being bigger than the Lizzies, not so suitable for short field landings. They sometimes land them if they have a lot of passengers to pick up. Maddie had flown a few other twin-engine bombers before, like the Whitley, but not a Hudson, and she slammed the tail a bit when she landed. Afterwards she spent a long time examining the tail wheel looking for prangs with 3 of the local ground crew, who decided there was nothing wrong with it. When she and Tom finally went into operations to get their ferry chits signed, the radio chap told Maddie politely, "You're to step into the debriefing room in the cottage for a few minutes if you don't mind. They're sending a driver. Your second pilot had better wait here." That was because the cottage is fairly out of bounds, even to people landing at the big airfield on legitimate business. But of course Maddie herself had been there before.
She swallowed an anguished sigh.
Court-martial?
No, it was just a heavy landing.
Tom had supported her loyally when they were talking about it with the ground crew, and the Air Ministry would laugh if she tried to file an accident report. She'd be court-martialed for wasting their time.
Oh, she thought, what have I done now?
The smart and charming first-aid nursing yeomanry girl, who does the driving for the Moon Squadron, didn't ask Maddie any questions. She is trained not to ask her passengers any questions. No room in the cottage is so severe and forbidding as the debriefing room. I do know. It was formerly a laundry, about 200 years ago, I think. All lime-washed stone walls and a big drain in the middle of the floor, and only an electric fire to heat it. Waiting in this tiger's lair for Maddie was our dear friend, the English intelligence officer with the pseudonym. I suppose you may want to dig his pseudonym out of me, but it's rather pointless. Could be anything now. He wasn't using it anymore when he interviewed Jamie early in 1942, and he certainly wasn't using it when he cornered Maddie in the laundry. The spectacles are unmistakable, and Maddie recognized him straight away and was so immediately suspicious she didn't step through the door. He was leaning casually against the shabby deal desk, which is all the permanent furniture in that room, flexing his bony hands in front of the electric fire.
"Second officer brought it."
The man is charming.
"Beastly rotten to surprise you like this, but one isn't able to arrange such meetings ahead of time, you know."
Maddie's eyes widened. She felt like Red Riding Hood staring at the wolf in Grandma's bed.
"What big eyes you have."
"Come in," he invited. "Do sit down."
There was a chair. There were two chairs, pulled up in front of the heater. Maddie could see that it was all set up as informally and cozily as it was possible to make this bleak little room. She swallowed again and sat down, and found the presence of mind to say something at last.
"Am I in trouble?"
He did not laugh. He sat down next to her, leaning over his knees with concern, drawing a line down his forehead. He said sharply,
"No, no, not at all. I've a job for you."
Maddie recoiled.
"Only if you're willing."
"I'm not..." She took a deep breath. "I can't do that kind of work."
This time he did laugh, a brief and quiet sympathetic chuckle. "Yes, you can. It's air taxi work. No intrigue attached." She stared at him with tight-lipped skepticism.
"It doesn't mean anything will change for you," he said. "No special missions to the continent."
Maddie gave him the ghost of a smile.
"You'll have to do some night landings, and you'll have to be available as needed. There won't be any advance notification for these flights."
"What are they for?" Maddie asked.
"Some of our people need fast and efficient private transport. Travel when and as needed. There and back in one night, no messing about with petrol rationing or limited speed on country lanes or awkward railway schedules. No risk of being recognized on a station platform or through the window of a motor car at traffic lights. Does that make sense?"
Maddie nodded. "You're a consistent pilot, a superb navigator, sharp as a tack and exceptionally discreet. There are plenty of men and several women better qualified than you, but none, I think, as appropriately suited for this particular taxi service. You remembered my name. You're well aware of our work here, and you keep quiet about it, except when you send us a recruit. If you take the assignments, they'll be given in the most straightforward manner through your ATA ferry pool. Eschitz, secret, with a report required. You won't be told anything about the men and women you'll be taxiing. You'll already know most of the airfields."
He is really very hard to resist, or perhaps Maddie just couldn't ever pass up a flying opportunity.
"I'll do it," she said decisively. "I'll do it."
"Tell your assistant pilot you left your clothing ration coupons here on your last flight and we've kept them for you."
He thumbed through a file folder, held something up at arm's length, then put it back with a sigh and pushed his heavy spectacles back up his nose.
"Getting old," he apologized. "The middle distance is going now too. Here we are."
He pored over the pages again and produced Maddie's clothing ration coupons. Her stomach turned over. She never found out how he got them. He handed them to her,
Explain to your colleague you were called in here today so we could return these and give you a lecture about taking greater care with your personal papers.
Well, I jolly well will be more careful with them after this, she told him fiercely.
God, what a mess. I have to stop here until I stop crying or it will all be illegibly smeared. Sorry, sorry, sorry.
Orme, 22-11-43, JBS. ATA Eschitz, secret. At first, it was much as he'd said. Very little in Maddie's life changed. For 6 weeks she heard nothing. Then, twice in a week, there were chits marked S, and bearing her own special code name. Just an alert to let her know she was operational, as it were. But the only way the job really differed from a normal taxi run was that the chaps she picked up weren't obviously pilots. After that, there were special flights that came regularly, but not frequently. Every 6 weeks or so. They were all prosaically dull. For taxi work, Maddie was put back to flying small training and ex-civil aircraft, open cockpit tiger moths and a puss moth or two. Apart from the occasional night landing, there wasn't much to the actual flying that Maddie found challenging. There was one Lysander flight that was memorable, because her passenger travelled with two guards. There is an armoured bulkhead that separates the Lysander pilot from her passengers. You can send her notes or coffee or kisses through an opening the size of a page, which she is able to shut against you if she wants, so that you cannot shoot her. Not that shooting your pilot would get you anywhere fast, except down in a Lysander, as you would not be able to take over the controls. Maddie was safely separated from her would-be assassin, if he was an assassin. She was never afterwards sure whether that passenger had travelled as a prisoner under guard or a liability under protection. At any rate, they must have been very crowded with three grown men in the back of the Lysander. Then, at last, there was me. Maddie was interrupted in the middle of a bedtime cocoa, very cosy, at home with her gran and grandad in their house in Stockport. Maddie's operations officer rang and asked her to make a flight to another airfield that night, collect someone and deliver that someone elsewhere, all to be done ASAP. She'd be told where to go when she got to Oakway, but not over the telephone. It was September a year ago. A gorgeous, glorious, clear and windless night. Some of the best flying weather Maddie had ever known. She scarcely had to fly the little puss moth, merely to point it southward along the darkling hills. A great, big, wonderful, waxing bomber's moon was rising as she arrived at the pickup airfield, and Maddie landed just before the local squadron took off. She taxied to the operations hut as the brand new Lancasters were leaving. The demure puss moth shuddered in the wind of their passing, like a marsh hen among a flock of grey herons. Each thrice her wingspan, each with four times as many engines, heavy with the night's fuel and payload of explosive, off to deliver vengeful destruction to Essen's factories and railway yards. Maddie taxied her little plane to the apron in front of the operations hut and idled the engine, waiting. She'd been told not to shut down. The Lancasters roared past. Maddie watched with her nose pressed to the windscreen and for a second didn't notice the passenger door being opened. Ground crew, caps pulled low and faces hidden in the wing's shadow, helped the passenger in and fastened her harness. There was no baggage, apart from the indispensable gas mask in its haversack, and as usual, Maddie wasn't told her special passenger's name. She saw the silhouette of a peaked WAF cap and could sense that the passenger was hugely keyed up, taut with excitement, but it never occurred to Maddie that she might know this person. Like the SOE drivers, she had been instructed not to ask questions. Over the purr of the engine, she shouted emergency exit instructions and the location of the first aid kit. Once airborne, Maddie didn't initiate conversation. She never did with special passengers. Nor did she point out how splendid the black and occasionally silver landscape was below them in the moonlight, because she knew that part of the reason this person was being flown to her destination at night was so she couldn't guess where she was going.
There was a gasp from the passenger when Maddie, all business, unclipped the very pistol from the side of her seat.
"Don't worry," Maddie shouted. "It's only a Phlegon. I haven't got a radio. The flare lets them know we're here. If they don't hear us buzzing them and put the lights on for us."
But Maddie didn't need to let off her firework display, because after circling for a minute or two, the runway lights blazed up, and Maddie put her own landing light on. It was a straightforward landing, but not until the aircraft had come to a full stop and the engine shut down did the passenger startle Maddie by leaning over and giving her a quick kiss on the cheek.
"Thank you. You are wonderful."
The ground crew had already opened the passenger's door.
"You should have told me it was you," Maddie cried as her friend gathered herself to disappear into the night. "I didn't like to surprise you in the air."
Queenie automatically checked that her hair was still in place and with one of her gazelle-like leaps vaulted from the plane onto the concrete.
"I'm not used to flying and I've never had to go anywhere at night. Sorry."
She leaned back into the cockpit for a moment. Maddie could see several figures beckoning and conferring behind her. It was nearly 2 a.m.
"Wish me luck," Queenie begged. "It's my first assignment."
"Good luck."
"I'll see you when I'm done. You're to take me home."
Queenie vanished across the concrete, surrounded by attendants. Maddie was given her own little guest room in the increasingly familiar cottage. It was odd not knowing what was going on. After a while, she dozed off and was almost instantly woken by that night's operational Lysanders returning from France with their booty of shot-down American airmen, hunted French ministers, a crate of champagne, and 16 bottles of Chanel No. 5. Maddie would not have known about the perfume, except that everybody was extraordinarily punchy the next morning, perhaps due to the champagne breakfast. Maddie, being scheduled to take off again after daybreak, prudently didn't take any champagne. Queenie was smug as a cat and glowing with success. She looked as though she'd just won herself a gold medal at the Olympic Games. The squadron leader gave a bottle of French scent to every woman who happened to be on the airfield, including the land girl, who turned up on her bicycle with a basket of 3 dozen unallocated eggs and 6 pints of milk for the Welcome to Freedom breakfast. Freedom. Oh, freedom. Even with the shortages and the blackout and the bombs and the rules and daily life so drab and dull most of the time, once you cross the English Channel, you are free. How simple and amazing, really, that no one in France lives without fear, without suspicion. I don't mean the straightforward fear of fiery death. I mean the insidious, demoralizing fear of betrayal, of treachery, of cruelty, of being silenced, of not being able to trust your neighbor or the girl who brings you eggs. Only 21 miles from Dover. Which would you rather have? An unlimited supply of Chanel No. 5? Or freedom? Stupid question, really. I have reached the point in this account where, unavoidably, I'm going to have to talk about myself before or May. And I don't want to. I just want to go on flying and flying in the moonlight. I dreamed I was flying with Maddie, in the 5 minutes or however short a time it was when there was a lull next door and I actually fell asleep. In my dream, the moon was full, but it was green, bright green. I kept thinking, we're in the limelight. But of course, limelight is white, not green. Chemical lime, not citrus. This was like the light in Chartreuse liqueur, like the green flash, and I kept wondering, how did I escape? I couldn't remember how I got out of Ormay. But it didn't matter. I was on my way home in Maddie's Pussmoth. I was safe, and Maddie was alongside me flying confidently, and the sky was quiet and full of the beautiful green moon. God, I'm tired. I truly shot myself in the foot again, and I'm now being forced to regret it. I have been put back to work till whenever they run out of people to keep an eye on me. Can't decide if this is good news or bad, as I don't mind the infinite supply of paper, but I also forfeited my cabbage soup tonight, and I didn't sleep much the past couple of nights either. I do wish they'd give up on that wretched French girl. She is never going to tell them anything. What happened was that when they brought me in this morning, poor Fräulein Engel was sitting at the table with her back to the door, busily numbering my countless recipe cards, and I frightened the living daylights out of her by braying in a deep, stentorian voice of command and discipline,
"Achtung, Anna Engel, Heil Hitler!"
She catapulted to her feet and threw herself into a salute that must have nearly dislocated her shoulder. I've never seen her look so white around the gills. She recovered almost immediately and smacked me so hard she knocked me over. When Thibaut picked me up, she smacked me again just for the sheer hell of it. Wow, 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 is my jaw sore. I suppose they are not planning another phony interview. I can never decide if it is worth it. It was a truly hilarious moment, but all I seem to have achieved this time is a totally unexpected collusion between Engel and Thibaut. Did I call them Laurel and Hardy? I meant sodding Romeo and Juliet. This is flirting, a la Gestapo underlings. She.
Oh, you are so strong and manly, Monsieur Thibaut. These knots you tie are so secure.
He. That is nothing. Look, I pull them so tight you cannot undo them. Try.
She. It is true, I cannot. Oh, pull them tighter.
He. Chérie, your wish is my command.
It is my ankles, not hers, which he is binding so tightly and with such masculine charm.
She.
I shall have to call you in tomorrow morning as well to do this task for me.
He.
You must cross the cord so, and knot them behind.
Me.
Squeak, squeak.
She. Shut up and write, ye wee skrike and Scots piece of shite.
Well, no, she did not use those exact words, but you get the idea. Something is up. They have stepped up the pace a bit, not just with me. They are relentless with the resistance prisoners. An inspection due, perhaps? A visit from von Linden's mysterious boss, the dreaded SS Sturmbannführer Ferber? I picture horns and a forked tail. Perhaps he's making an inquiry into von Linden's work here. That would explain why VL's got to get these notes of his in order. Trying to make himself look good. Desperately trying to marshal my own thoughts in narrative order. I am very tired and, shall I be melodramatic about it, rather faint with hunger. In fact, I don't know if it's hunger I am faint with, but I am very hungry and feeling quite light-headed. I have not been allowed any more aspirin since the episode with the cognac. Perhaps Engel has given me concussion. I am going to make some lists to try to get through the next bit. Flights with Maddie. 4 columns. Date, departure, destination, return. September 1942. Night flight. From Buscot Aerodrome, Oxford, to unknown, special duties. Back to Buscot, next day. September. From Buscot. To Branston. Back to Buscot. October. Buscot. To unknown, northeast. Back to Newcastle, then by train to Oxford. October. Buscot. To Ipswich. Return train to Oxford. November 1942. From Buscot. To unknown, northeast. Return same as above. January 43, night flight. From Buscot to unknown, SD. Back to Buscot. January. Oakway to Glasgow. Then back to Newcastle, then train to Manchester. January. From Oakway to Glasgow, back on the train to Oxford. The weather at Glasgow was so dreadful that day that no one would take off and everyone was stuck there. I took the train back, but Maddie had to wait for a gap in the clouds. And sod in Glasgow still wasn't finished with me, so I had to go back in February 43, from Oakway to Glasgow. Back, who cares? March. 5 flights, various, all in southern England, 2 at night. April. Oh. RAF Special Duties, Operational Cross Country. I did take the train to assignments too, more often than I flew. And Maddie taxied other people besides me, who in all likelihood were not doing the same work as me. But those flights I've just listed are the flights that count. 15 flights in 6 months. Maddie took the secrecy more seriously than I did. I was never sure how much she guessed. Turns out not much. She just genuinely took it seriously. After all, she started as a clerk special duties. On that night last April, we had to go back to that airfield, the secret one, the one that Moon Squadron uses for France. Jamie was stationed there now. Maddie was in the know with them, and had been for some time. Trusted. Accepted. Invited to supper that night, in fact. No supper for poor Queenie, though, who was instantly whisked away by the usual mob. Really, my reception committee only consisted of about 3 people, including my admirer, the RAF police sergeant, who doubles as security guard and chief sausage fryer for the cottage, but it feels like a mob when everyone is bigger than you and you don't know where you're being taken. Queenie had a small travelling case which she left with Maddie, and from experience, Maddie knew she wouldn't see her friend again until at least tomorrow morning. Maddie went to supper with the pilots. It wasn't something she did often, you know, once in a season perhaps, and it was special because Jamie was there. In fact, he was about to go on a drop-off and pick-up mission that night, a double Lysander operation as they called it, 2 pilots flying 2 planes to the same field. There was a 3rd plane taking off with them, taking advantage of the moon, but not technically operational, a new squadron member doing his first cross-country training flight to France. He'd part company with the others over the channel. He'd fly into France on his own for a bit, then turn back without landing. This young fellow, let's call him Michael, after the youngest of the Darling children in Peter Pan, was quite nervous about his navigation skills. Like Jamie, he'd previously been a bomber pilot and had always had a navigator sitting next to him telling him where to go, and also, he'd only flown his first Lysander a month ago. His mates were full of sympathy, having all been through it themselves. Maddie was not.
"You've been practicing on Lizzie's for a month," she said scornfully. "Crumbs! How long does it take? The instruments are the same whether you fly in a Barracuda dive bomber or a clapped-out old tiger moth, and the flaps are automatic. Easy peasy."
They all gave her looks.
"You go on and fly to France, then," said Michael.
"I would if you'd let me," she said enviously, not remembering about anti-aircraft guns and night fighters.
"I ken what to do," drawled Jamie, the pobble who has no toes, dragging out his vowels to make them exaggeratedly Scots. "Tak the wee lassie alang."
Maddie felt as though she'd been struck by lightning. She looked up at him and saw the familiar, faint lunacy shining in Jamie's eyes. She knew better than to say anything herself. Either the pobble would win on her behalf or she couldn't go. The others laughed and argued briefly. The English SOE agent who was being dropped off that night was disapproving. The Moon Squadron pilots, of necessity a bunch of giddy lunatics, put it to their leader as a proposition. He was clearly torn, but chiefly because Michael was supposed to be solo that night.
"She won't be helping him fly the plane in the back of a Lysander, will she?"
"She could tell him what to do. Keep him straight if he goes off course." Jamie pushed his empty plate away and leaned back in his chair, his hands behind his head, and gave a low whistle.
"Ooh-ee! Are you suggesting she's a superior pilot to our Michael?"
They all gazed at Maddie, sitting quietly in her civilian uniform, looking very trim and official with her gold wings and gold stripes. She was a first officer by now. The only person whose eyes she dared to meet were those of the agent who was going to be dropped off that night. He was shaking his head in defeated disapproval as much as to say, "If you must, my lips are sealed."
"I've no doubt she's a superior pilot," the squadron leader said.
"Well, what in creation is she doing ferrying clapped-out tiger moths about in that case? Give the bloody Machiavellian English intelligence officer a ring and get permission," Jamie suggested.
Michael said rather excitedly, "Don't count it as my operational cross-country. I need the practice."
"If it's not an operational flight," said the squadron leader, "there's no need to ring intelligence. I'll take responsibility."
Maddie had won. She could scarcely believe her luck.
I don't want this out of this room, the squadron leader said, and everybody looked blank, shrugging with innocence and indifference.
Maddie walked shoulder to shoulder with the SOE agent when they went out to climb into the waiting aircraft. The ground crew gave her funny looks.
Michael needing help with his navigation again? One of them asked kindly, offering her a leg up the ladder into the back of the plane.
Secretly, Maddie thought Michael was as lucky as a boy with jam smeared all over his face, with his carefully annotated map marked with every single anti-aircraft gun and navigation pinpoint all the way into the middle of France and back. She didn't have her own map, sitting in the back, but she had an absolutely fabulous view out of both sides and behind, a view she didn't normally get, and the leisure to enjoy it. She had a job, too, keeping her eyes peeled for night fighters. It wasn't far over the blacked-out villages of southern England before they reached the coast. The great golden moon made the blue lights on the wingtips of the operational Lysanders ahead of them scarcely distinguishable from stars. They bobbed and winked in and out of Maddie's line of sight, but she knew where she was. That river, that chalk quarry, that estuary in the glimmering night. Familiar landmarks. Then the unbelievable bright loveliness of the English Channel. A shimmering, infinite lamé cloth of silver and blue. Maddie could see the black silhouettes of a convoy of ships below her. She wondered how long it would take the Luftwaffe to find them.
"Oi, Michael!" Maddie called out over the intercom. "You're not meant to follow that lot into France. You're supposed to change your heading here and go further south on your own, aren't you?"
She heard a lot of cursing from the front before the pilot pulled himself together and reset his course. Then she heard his sheepish, "Thanks, mate." "Thanks, mate." Maddie hugged herself with pride and pleasure.
"I'm one of them," she thought. "I'm on my way to France. I might as well be operational."
Deep in her stomach, she nursed two cringing, niggling fears. One, that they might be fired on. And two, court-martial. But she knew Michael's route had been carefully plotted to avoid guns and airfields, and that their most dangerous moment had probably been when they crossed the shipping convoy. If they made it home safely, there would be no need for court-martial. If they didn't make it home safely, well, presumably court-martial wouldn't be much of a problem in that case either. Now they were over the ghostly white cliffs of eastern Normandy. The Seine's loops shone like a great unwinding spool of silver mesh off the port wingtip. Maddie gasped at the river's inadvertent loveliness, and all at once she found herself spilling childish tears, not just for her own besieged island, but for all of Europe. How could everything have come so fearfully and thoroughly unraveled? There were no lights over France. It was as blacked out as Britain. Europe's lamps had all gone out.
"What's that?"
she gasped into the intercom. Michael saw it at the same time and banked sharply away. He began to circle, a hair too steeply at first, then with steadier rudder control. Below and ahead of them, lit up like a ghastly funfair, was a rectangle of stark, garish white light desecrating an otherwise blacked-out landscape.
"That's where the last pinpoint is supposed to be," Michael told her. "Some pinpoint? Is it an airfield? It's jolly well operational if it is."
"No," said the pilot slowly, as he circled back and got another look. "No, I think it's a prison camp. Look, the lighting's around the perimeter fence, to catch anyone trying to get out."
"Are you in the right place?"
Maddie asked dubiously.
"You tell me."
But he said it with confidence. He stuffed his waymarked map back through the opening in the bulkhead, followed by a pocket-sized electric torch. "Keep that under cover," he said. "There's supposed to be an airfield 20 miles to the east. I've been trying to steer clear of it. I damn well don't need an escort." Maddie studied the map beneath a tent she made of her tunic. Michael was smartly on target as far as she could tell. The glaring prison fence was close to a railway bridge over a river, which should have been the turning back point. Maddie switched off the torch and stared out of the window, her night vision ruined by trying to read the map. But she could tell they had turned back. "You didn't need my help after all," she said, and passed him back his torch and map.
I'd have just played follow my leader after Jamie all the way to Paris if you hadn't reminded me to turn.
He's not going to Paris, is he?
Michael said enviously. He won't get to buzz the Eiffel Tower, but he's picking up a couple of Parisian agents. He'll have to land well outside the city. Then Michael added in a more sober voice, I'm still jolly glad you came along. That prison gave me a turn. I was so sure I was in the right place, and then...
You were,
said Maddie. I'm jolly glad you came along, Michael repeated. He said it a third time when they landed back in England 2 hours later. The relieved squadron leader grinned and nodded tolerantly as he welcomed them back.
Find your way, all right.
A piece of cake, apart from the bit at the end where the pinpoint turned out to be next to a bloody great prison. The squadron leader laughed.
I'll say you did find your way. That always comes as a surprise the first time. Proves you got there, though. Or did you have help?
He found it all himself, Maddie said truthfully. I can't thank you enough for letting me go along.
April in Paris, eh?
Nearly as good as. Maddie ached for Paris, imprisoned, inaccessible, remote.
Not this year, perhaps next.
Michael went to bed whistling. Maddie found her way through the darkened cottage with his tune stuck in her head. After a moment, she recognized it as the last time I saw Paris. Debriefing. It was nearly 4 o'clock in the morning when, brimming with elation, Maddie crept into the room she was sharing with Queenie. She checked the blackout blinds were down and then lit a candle, not wanting to put on the lights and wake her friend if Queenie was asleep. But Queenie's bed was empty and unruffled, the counterpane smooth and straight. Queenie's small travel case stood unopened by the foot of the bed, where Maddie herself had set it down earlier. Whatever Queenie was here to do, she was still doing it. Maddie put on her pajamas and pulled the blankets up to her chin, her mind full of air and moonlight and the silver Seine. She did not sleep. Queenie came in at 5:30. She didn't think about whether or not she'd wake Maddie. She didn't even check that the blinds were down. She snapped on the electric light overhead, heaved her travel case onto the bare bureau, and hauled out the regulation waff pajamas and a hairbrush. Then she sat down in front of the mirror and stared at herself. Maddie stared too. Queenie was different. Her hair was pinned up as usual, but not in the signature French chignon twist she'd been wearing when Maddie had left her last night. Queenie's hair was scraped back severely from her forehead, flat against her skull, and wound into a tight bun at the nape of her neck. It wasn't flattering. It made her seem plainer, and her face was made up in pale colors that weren't flattering either. There was a harshness to the set of her mouth that Maddie had never seen before. Maddie watched. Queenie laid down the hairbrush and slowly took off her blue waff tunic. After a moment, Maddie realized she was being cautious, not slow, moving carefully as though it were painful to stretch her shoulders. She took off her blouse. One arm was livid with bruises, red turning purple, the clear, brutal marks of a big hand that had gripped her hard and not let go for some time. Her throat and shoulders were scored with similar ugly marks right the way round. Someone had tried to choke her to death a few hours ago. She touched her throat gently and stretched her neck, examining the damage in the small mirror on the dresser. The room wasn't very warm, and after a minute or two, Queenie sighed and inched herself into the cotton shirt of her men's pajamas, still moving cautiously. Then she stood up, incautiously this time, and wrenched all the steel hairpins from her tightly bound hair. With a vicious scrape of the back of one hand, she scrubbed the beige lipstick from her mouth. Suddenly, she looked very much more herself, a bit disheveled, as though she'd pulled off a mask. She turned round and saw Maddie looking at her. Hello, Queenie said with a crooked smile. I didn't mean to wake you.
You didn't.
Maddie waited. She knew better than to ask what had happened. You saw? Maddie nodded.
Doesn't hurt,
Queenie said fiercely. Not much, just... It was hard work tonight. Had to do a bit more improvisation than usual. Play it closer to the edge. She scrabbled abruptly in her tunic for her cigarettes. Maddie watched quietly, Queenie sat down on the edge of Maddie's bed and lit a cigarette with hands that shook a little.
"Guess where I went with the lads tonight," Maddie said.
"To the pub?"
"To France."
Queenie spun round to stare at her and saw the sky and the moon still lighting up Maddie's eyes.
"France!"
Maddie hugged her knees, reeling with the magic and menace of that stolen flight.
"You're not supposed to tell me that," Queenie said.
"I'm not," Maddie agreed.
"I wasn't even supposed to have gone. But we didn't actually land there."
Queenie nodded and examined her cigarette. Maddie had never seen her friend quite so undone.
"You know what you looked like just now?" Maddie said.
"When you came in, with your hair pulled back in that strict Victorian governess way, you looked like..."
"Eine Agentin der Nazis," Queenie supplied, taking a long, shaking drag on her cigarette.
"What?"
"Oh. Yes, like a German spy. Or everyone's idea of a German spy, anyway. Fair and scary."
"I think I'm a bit small for the Aryan ideal," Queenie said, observing herself critically.
She stretched her neck again, felt the bruised arm cautiously and raised the cigarette to her lips, more steadily this time. Maddie did not ask what had happened. She was never so petty. She did not dabble with minnows at the surface when there were 30-pound salmon swimming deeper down.
"What?" Maddie said quietly. "Do you actually do?"
"Careless talk costs lives," Queenie retorted.
"I don't talk," Maddie said. "What do you do?"
"I speak German. Ich bin eine..."
"Be sensible," Maddie said. "You translate."
"What?"
"Who do you translate for?"
Queenie turned towards her again with the narrow gaze of a hunted rodent.
"You translate for prisoners of war? You work for intelligence? You translate at interrogations?"
Queenie hid herself in a cloud of smoke.
"I'm not a translator," she said.
"But you said..."
"No."
Queenie was quiet too.
"You said that."
"I told you I speak German. But I'm not a translator. I'm an interrogator."
"It is ridiculous that you have not already guessed the nature of my intelligence work, Amadeus von Linden. Like you, I am a wireless operator. Like you, I am bloody good at it. Our methods differ. On the job, as it were, I am called Ava Seiler. That was the name they used for me throughout my training. We were made to live and breathe our alter egos, and I got used to it. Seiler is the name of my school and was easy to remember. We had to discipline people who called me Scotty by accident. In English, I can fake an Orkney accent better than a German one, so we went with that when I was operational. Obscurely difficult to identify. That first day, that first assignment, the very first one. Remember how giddy everyone was the morning after, when they handed out all the champagne and perfume at the cottage? I'd caught a double agent. A Nazi agent masquerading as a French resistance courier. They'd suspected him, and they brought me in to be there when they landed him in England. I caught him off guard at the low ebb of his strength and adrenaline. He'd had a long night being hauled out of France, they all did. He was a known womanizer. He didn't have the balls to admit he didn't recognize me when I threw myself at him in that frosty little debriefing room, laughing and weeping and exclaiming in German. The room was bugged and they heard everything we said. It wasn't always that easy, but it paved my way. Mostly, these men were all so desperate or confused by the time I appeared, with my neutral Swiss accent and comfortingly official checklist, that they were often gratefully cooperative, if not wholly bewitched. But not this night. Not on the night last April when Maddie flew to France. The man I interviewed that night didn't believe in me. He accused me of treachery. Treason against the fatherland. What was I doing working for the enemy, the English? He called me a collaborator, a backstabber, a filthy English whore. You know, The stupid man's big mistake was in calling me English. It made my fury wholly convincing. A whore, we've established that. Filthy, it goes without saying. But whatever else the hell I am not English. You're the one who's failed the fatherland. You're the one who's been caught, I snarled at him. And you're the one who will face trial when you're returned to Stuttgart. I recognized his accent. A coincidence and a direct hit. I am merely here doing my job as Berlin's interpretive liaison. Oh yes, I said that. And how dare you call me English? At which point, he launched himself at me. We don't usually bind these men, and took my head beneath his arm in a grip of iron. Call for help, he commanded. I could have escaped. I've been trained to defend myself against an attack like that, as I think I proved during the street brawl when I was arrested. Why? Still sneering at him. Call for help. Let your English masters come to your aid or I will break your neck. Calling the English for help would be collaboration, I gasped coldly. I don't depend on the English for anything. Go ahead and break my neck. They were watching, you know. There is a slotted window to the kitchen which they can watch through. And if I had called for help or seemed anything but wholly in control, they would have come to my aid. But they saw what I was doing, what a tight wire I was walking, and they sat biting their nails and let me win that battle on my own. And I did win. It ended some time later with him breaking down in tears on the floor, clutching at my leg and begging me to forgive him. Tell me your assignment, I commanded. Tell me your contacts and I will filter what I pass on to the English. Tell me, and you have confessed to your countrywoman and given nothing to the enemy. I am shameless. Tell me, and perhaps I will forgive you for threatening to murder me. His behavior then was truly embarrassing, and I actually kissed him on the top of his head in benediction when he had finished. Miserable, nasty man. Then I did call for help, but with disdain and dismissal, not with fear.
Good show, my dear. My, you've nerves of steel, haven't you? Jolly good show, first rate.
I didn't let on how much he'd hurt me, and they didn't think to check. It was that night's nerves of steel that landed me in France 6 weeks ago. I forgot to change my hair back to normal when I changed my clothes. I don't wear my WAF uniform for interrogations. The hair was a small mistake. They took the nerves of steel into account, but not the small mistake. They didn't notice that he'd hurt me, and they didn't notice that I do make small, fatal mistakes from time to time. But Maddie noticed both. Come and get warm, she said. Queenie stubbed out her cigarette and turned off the light. She didn't get into her own bed, though. She climbed in next to Maddie. Maddie put careful arms round the bruised shoulders because her friend was shaking all over now. She hadn't been before. It's not a nice job, Queenie whispered. It's not like your job. Blameless. I'm not blameless, said Maddie. Every bomber I deliver goes operational and kills people. Civilians. People like my gran and granddad. Children. Just because I don't do it myself doesn't mean I'm not responsible. I deliver you. Blonde bombshell, Queenie said, and spluttered with laughter at her own joke. Then she began to cry. Maddie held her lightly, thinking she would let go when her friend stopped crying. But she cried for so long that Maddie fell asleep first, so she didn't ever let go.
My heart is sad, I dare not tell. My heart is sad for somebody. Oh, I could wake a winter's night, all for the sake of somebody. The powers that smile on virtuous love, oh, sweetly smile on somebody. Free ilka danger, keep her free, and send me safe, my somebody. We two he paddled in the burn, three morning sun till dine, but seas between us broad he roards and no lang syne. For auld lang syne, my friend, for auld lang syne, we'll tak a cup o' kindness yet for auld lang syne. Oh God, I am so tired. They've kept me at it all night. 'Tis the third night I've had no sleep. Too little, at any rate. I don't recognize any of the people guarding me. Thibaut and Engel are all tucked up in their pension, and von Linden is busy tormenting that screaming French girl. I like writing about Maddie. I like remembering. I like constructing it, focusing, crafting the story, pulling together the memories. But I am so tired. I can't craft anything more tonight. Whenever I seem to stop, to stretch, to reach for another sheet of paper, to rub my eyes, this utter shit of a bastard who is guarding me touches the back of my neck with his cigarette. I am only writing this because it stops him burning me. He cannot read English or Scots, and as long as I keep covering page after page with lines from Tam O'Shanter, he does not hurt me. I can't keep it up forever, but I know an awful lot of Robert Burns by heart. Burns, haha. Burns to stop the burns. Behead me or hang me, that will never fear me. I'll burn Ochan Doon ere my life leave me. Burning, 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 burning. Oh God, those pictures, burning. Maddie. Maddie. 4 May, 23-11-43, JBS. Von Linden himself put an end to the proceedings last night. Came storming in like the charge of the Light Brigade and swept the pages together while I fell flat on my face on the table in a pool of ink with my eyes closed. Lord God Almighty, Visor, are you an idiot? She will not produce anything worth reading when she's in this state. Look! This is verse. English doggerel. Pages and pages of it. The Jerry Philistine proceeded to wad everything I can remember of Tam O'Shanter into balls of waste paper. I think he may read more English than he lets on if he recognizes Burns as English. Burn this rubbish. I have more than enough irrelevant nonsense out of her without you encouraging it. Give her water and take her back to her room, and get rid of that filthy cigarette. We will talk about that tomorrow. Which was as emotional an outburst as I have ever heard from him. But I think he is overtired too. Oh yes, and Engel has been crying. Her eyes are very red and she keeps scrubbing at her nose, which is red too. I wonder what would make on-duty female guard Fräulein Engel blub on the job. Special Operations Training. After that disastrous interview last April, it wasn't disastrous for intelligence, I suppose, but it left Eva Seiler a bit damaged. Berlin's interpretive liaison was given a week's leave to think about her work and whether she wanted to continue it. In other words, Queenie was given the opportunity to gracefully bow out. She spent the week in Castle Craig with her lady mother, the long-suffering Mrs. Darling, as it were. Poor Mrs. Darling never had a clue what any of her six children were actually doing, or when they were coming or going, and she was not best pleased at the black marks on her fine-boned daughter's Celtic white skin. Pirates, Queenie said. I was bound to the mast by Captain Hook. When this dreadful war is over, said her mother, I want to know absolutely every last detail. Absolutely every last detail of my work falls under the Official Secrets Act, and I will be thrown into prison for the rest of my life if I ever tell you anything about it, Queenie told her mother. So stop asking. Ross, the youngest of the Glaswegian evacuees, overheard this conversation. It was just as well Queenie hadn't given her lady mother any details.
careless talk costs lives, etc. But the official-looking, pretty wireless operator became rather a worshipped goddess among the Craig Castle irregulars after that.
She had been held prisoner.